Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Gregory Melville and Susan Fox and Kathleen Bromage.
Dr. Eddie S. Glaude Jr. wears many hats. He's a longtime academic, a best-selling author, and a regular analyst for MSNBC. 4 years ago, he spoke about how many people don't acknowledge the history of racism in the U.S.
It's easy for us to place it all on Donald Trump's shoulders. It's easy for us to place Pittsburgh on his shoulders. It's easy for me to place Charlottesville on his shoulders. It's easy for us to place El Paso on his shoulders. This is us.
In 2011, Professor Glaude gave a series of lectures at Harvard University. It was part of the school's W.E.B. Du Bois lectures. They recognized people for contributing to the way that we understand African and African-American life. For his lectures, Professor Glaude focused on three civil rights leaders, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., Ella Baker, and Malcolm X. Glaude explained how reading Malcolm X's autobiography deeply affected him.
Malcolm became then a surrogate father. His words offered a vivid picture of the kind of self I needed to create in order to become a man who would not be swallowed whole by a broken relationship with his father.
This is Disrupted. I'm Kalila Brown-Dean. Those 2011 lectures inspire Professor Glaude's new book, We Are the Leaders We Have Been Looking For. He makes the case that we can't rely too much on the leadership of others. We have to focus on the leaders within. Dr. Eddie S. Glaude Jr. is James S. McDonald Distinguished University Professor of African American Studies at Princeton University. Professor, it's great to have you back on Disrupted.
It's good to see you again. How are you?
I am doing well, and I'm looking forward to this conversation with you. You have the distinction of many things, but you are our most frequent guest on Disrupted. So we always love to talk with you.
I love that distinction. Yes.
We can add it. This newest book, I want to get right into it. It's based on a series of lectures that you gave back in 2011. Tell us what was happening during that time that shaped your approach to these lectures.
Well, you know, on so many levels, it was really about my response to the Obama era. I was really trying to, you know, open up space for a different kind of politics. One that wasn't so beholden to the idea that Obama was the fulfillment of the Black political struggle. But at the heart of it was a deep suspicion about the way in which Black politics and the way in which American democracy was being conducted. And I think that suspicion bore itself out.
Let's be frank, you were criticized quite a bit for raising those points, because many people couldn't see it as the context and nuance and really the sense of agency of Black politics that you were trying to bring forth. Instead, it became narrowed as this is an attack on Barack Obama, as opposed right. to an indictment of the very narrow ways that people were trying to constrain Black politics. And you've also talked about the elements of culture that get overlooked when we singularly focus on a person. Thinking about where we are now in 2024 and the things you were raising in 2011 and some of the criticism you encountered, do you think the critique was fair, or do you think that people couldn't see past the context because we were so protective of Barack Obama and for what many people, I'm thinking of elders here, of what he represented as the first?
You know, I think I don't know so much if it was fair, but it was earnest. You know, there's a sense in which I don't want to say that the criticism emanated from a malevolent space, because it was obviously true that Barack Obama was the object of a kind of white racist backlash. And there were efforts to protect his right flank, his left flank, his rear flank, and the like. But I think There's a reason why Occupy Wall Street emerged during the Obama administration. There's a reason why Black Lives Matter emerged, because there was this effort to green screen Obama as this kind of left-leaning politician who was going to change the course of the direction of the country, when it turned out that by the way he was governing, and those moments in which he chastised Black folk in what I take to be a very condescending way, that he was in so many ways just an extension of Clintonism. And now a lot of people will get mad at me for saying that, but it's okay. I've dealt with that. I think my biggest insight looking back on these lectures and trying to pull them into this current moment is my unadulterated faith in everyday ordinary people. That we don't need folk guiding us. We don't need to be treated like cattle chewing cud, right? That we need to figure out a politics that affirms the dignity and standing of everyday ordinary people. But more importantly, we need to stop outsourcing our responsibility to democracy, to others. And I think that through line from 2011 to now, right, connects all of the work.
Let's talk about that responsibility that, as you said, gets outsourced, but also displaces the sense of collective responsibility. The title of your new book is We Are the Leaders We Have Been Looking For. Why do you think that there's this tendency to look toward other people or expect others to lead in these fights and these struggles, which, as you have said throughout your career, are struggles that have to be individual within community?
You know, it's easier to expect others to fight for you. I mean, we live in a representative democracy, right? So there's a sense in which it's already built in that every 2-4 years we elect politicians who represent our interests, at least purportedly or supposedly. So it's rather easy. And then you combine that with the fact that, you know, we're busting our behinds, Doc, trying to make ends meet, trying to keep our noses above water, trying to raise our children, trying to figure out how to be decent and loving and caring in a world that is often organized in such a way that makes decency, loving, and caring very difficult to enact. And so I understand that, right? I understand that. But, you know, the heroine of the book is Ella Baker. And the title of the book comes from her, right? And that is the sense that, you know, when we create the conditions close to the ground, right, not in some abstract sense where we're trying to lobby, you know, Washington, D.C., or sit in the Oval Office and you know, engage in the backroom dealing that has always been a part of Black politics. But when we insist on organizing close to the ground, we find that everyday ordinary people exhibit the characteristics necessary for self-governance, for the kind of character, the character formation necessary for democracy to flourish. Right? It's like Ms. Baker telling those young SNCC organizers, shut up and listen, you might learn something. And so I think there's a vested interest, as I've said before, in a custodial form of politics. There's a Black political class, and there's a political class generally that's invested in our outsourcing our responsibility to them because we don't hold them accountable, you see. But I think we need to hold ourselves accountable. And that takes us to the basic insight in the book. And it might sound a bit cliche, but, you know, if we are the leaders we've been looking for, we have to become better people. And if we're going to become better people, we have to make a more just world, because the world as it's currently organized gets in the way of us being better people, you see. So even though I have faith in us, I still want us to reach for higher forms of excellences.
As I was reading the book, I kept thinking this very basic question, which is, what does it mean to be a leader? And I ask that question now because too often we have assumed that to be a leader requires a title or a position or a particular education class background. And what you've just mentioned are the people who are leading in spaces every day, teachers who are trying to protect their children and affirm them in a context that tells them books are bad, self-affirmation is bad. we're talking about mothers and fathers that are working multiple jobs so their children can have more, not in terms of material things, but opportunity and access. That's leadership. And yet we often think it requires an election, an appointment, or an anointing in some ways of how people ascend to that. How are you defining what it means to be a leader?
Right there. You're right in the pocket, it seems to me. You know, Miss Baker used to say that strong people don't need strong leaders. I love that formulation, right? And, you know, we often think of African-American leadership in terms of the mid-20th century, you know, of the Black Freedom Movement, people leading marches or, you know, charismatic figures, mostly men emerging to kind of tell us where we should go, and we should lay down our hoes and our axes and our shovels and follow them, you know. But I'll never forget the story Bob Moses told me. There were folk, sharecroppers on a bus that they were going to register to vote in Sunflower County. And they were all scared because they knew what they were driving to or driving towards. And this woman in the back was just singing every hymn in the book, in the hymnal, wouldn't stop singing. And people were like, what's going on? And then someone said, wait a minute now, I think she's trying to fortify the spirit here. And you know who that woman was? It was Fannie Lou Hamer. Out of the blue. You create the context under which people can find the prophets within themselves, the heroic within themselves, and they will act out. I mean, they will act on it. History will call them. I know they will, just like it called these grand folk that overshadow us in so many ways. So my conception of leadership is really rooted in a phrase that you see throughout the book, and that is close to the ground, right? Not in an abstract sense of legacy civil rights organizations or these leaders who are larger than life, but everyday ordinary people at the local level, engaging in the hard work of forging decent lives, of ensuring a better future for their family, not only their families, but their communities and the people they don't know. Because, you know, as Ralph Ellison says, democracy at its best is a disinterested form of love. And that means I don't have to know you in order to want to build a world where you can flourish and thrive. And I think that has to happen close to the ground, not in some abstract way. So, yeah, absolutely. We agree completely on this definition of leadership.
Here's what I worry about, Professor.
Sure.
Being a leader is very difficult. It can be exhausting. It can be overwhelming, especially in these times where trust seems so low, skepticism is high at every level, where it used to be more closer to the ground, you saw higher levels of trust because those are the people that you knew. And now we're in a moment where to be a leader means you're criticized for not doing enough fast enough or doing too much too soon. And that gets in the way of the sort of common goals that we have because the question becomes why that person or why in that particular way. And that I think is universal, but it is particularly true for Black folks who have Right. felt burned in some ways or overlooked. How do we address that tension between those who feel called to lead wherever they are and the collective skepticism and uncertainty that they have to navigate?
As I think about it, we have to interrogate the motivation for why we lead. We don't lead to be loved, we lead in love. You see the difference in that preposition? We don't lead to be loved. We lead in love. And so one day you might be, you know, the talk of the town, and the next minute you might be, you know, demonized. One minute you're considered the moral voice of the nation. The next minute you're the most loathed and hated man on the planet, Dr. King. One minute everyone is listening to you. 1963, Baldwin is on the cover of Time magazine. By 1987, when he took his last breath, nobody was paying attention to him. So I think part of what we have to do is to understand the motivation that leads us to step into the breach. What motivates us to do this? And this is part of the argument in the book that's really key, the character question. What does it mean to engage in the ongoing work of self-cultivation in the pursuit of justice? That is to say, what does it mean for me, to use James W.C. Pennington's language, to engage in the hard work of making myself more efficient for good? That means I have to have an honest assessment of what's in my heart, to leave behind a self in order to reach for a higher self. And see, sometimes Black folk get locked into these things because, you know, we think just because you're Black, you got to be this, that, and the other. No. We have to be constantly evolving and engaging in self-creation. So we have to interrogate the motivation, because if you are out here fighting just because you want folk to love you, you know, then you're going to get in trouble on so many different levels.
Coming up, more with Dr. Eddie S. Glaw Jr. He'll share how reading the autobiography of Malcolm X shaped his worldview. This is Disrupted. We'll be right back.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford HealthCare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford HealthCare. ECMO is a leading-edge, life-saving treatment for patients with cardiac or respiratory failure. Dr. Jason Gluck, director of the Mechanical Circulatory Support Program and Emergency Cardiac Care at Hartford Hospital, explains what it is.
So ECMO stands for extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, outside the body oxygenation of blood. It's a life support technique that's used by highly sophisticated medical systems for patients with severe heart or lung failure. The technique involves removing blood from the body, oxygening it, and then returning it back.
ECMO procedures happen in the ICU, but not all hospitals are equipped with the necessary technology and staff. Dr. Gluck describes Hartford Hospital's ECMO Go team.
So ECMO is considered when treatments have failed. And in our center, with a special ECMO on the Go team, we'll actually take that technology to their hospital and help them out there if they need to stabilize the patient and then bring them back to heart for recovery.
For more information, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
Welcome back to Disrupted. I'm Kalila Brown-Dean. Today, we're talking with Professor Eddie S. Glaw Jr. about his new book, We Are the Leaders We Have Been Looking For. In the book, Glaw discusses something that he calls Black Democratic Perfectionism. I asked him to tell us more about that concept.
Well, that's that self-cultivation in pursuit of justice, right? So, you know, part of our challenge has always been, you know, white folks' assumptions about who we are and the way in which those assumptions box us in, lock us in the cage, you know, tie down our wings, as it were. And so what I'm trying to do in the book is to disrupt this nonsense, this silly distinction between kind of communal orientation and a kind of individual self-cultivation. You know, I'm not commending an individualism where you can, you know, be narcissistic and self-interested. You know, that's just neoliberalism gone amok, right? Part of what I'm trying to suggest, though, is that when Black folk, when we, everyday ordinary folk, assume the meaning and significance of reaching for higher forms of excellences in the face of the world, then we're talking about revolution, because we're moving outside of scripted spaces. You're supposed to be that. You're only supposed to be this. What does it mean for Jimmy Baldwin to imagine himself as a world-class writer and to step into that? Right. But to understand at the same time that he can't be who he feels himself to be, who he can't reach for a higher self because the world has boxed him in. She can't become a Toni Morrison because the world has boxed her in. So part of the challenge is you got to work on the world as you work on yourself. And I use the example of James W.C. Pennington here, going back to him first African-American to attend classes at Yale. He couldn't get in the classroom. He had to sit outside. 1849, Heidelberg University gave him an honorary degree. In The Fugitive Blacksmith, he said this. He said this, Dr. Dean. He said, slavery is a vile monster. The one thing I could never forgive slavery for is that it robbed me of my education. He said, it took me years to get rid of the sound of slavery on my tongue, but I cannot replace that which I was not exposed to. And all I've ever tried to do is make myself more efficient for good. So what you get in that moment is the elements of perfectionism. You get self-loathing, you get shame. His demand to reach for a higher self so that he could become more efficient for good required that he fight for a world that's more just. And so now you're not just simply selfish trying to get your bag. You can't just be out here, oh, I'm working on me. I need to engage in self-care. Just get in your bag and not concerned about how the world is arranged. So when we act like this, all hell breaks loose, you see, because we're the fixed star in America's imagination. So when we start behaving in ways that are fully who we are, oh, we're recasting the die at that point, it seems to me.
It's no secret. I hope I'm not bridging any confidences here, Professor. You are someone who I will reach out occasionally just to say, hey, just checking in. How are you? I do that with others who are in these very public-facing roles because I know in my own experiences how quickly people are there to attack and to tear down for a soundbite or a viral tweet or just to feel like I need to knock you down a peg without remembering the person and what it means to be so vulnerable because in speaking your truth, it automatically forces others to confront their truths in ways that they have violently protected the veneer that others see. It's why in this book, when you talk about what Malcolm X meant to you as a person, not just as a scholar, I see that connection of a man who was grossly misunderstood in his time, then became sort of valorized after his death, and still, even with that attention, became reduced to this sort of image that others wanted to have. And that's where I see the connection between the personal, the scholarly, and the political, and why I think this book at this time is so critical.
Thank you. And oh my God, every time I look up and I see a message from you, my heart smiles deeply. So thank you, because you need to check in. I need folk to check in on me because I'm not okay. You know, in the introduction to the book, I say that I look back, you know, to echo Toni Morrison's documentary, I look back to pick up the pieces that I am, to try to right myself into some sense of stability in some way. So, you know, and to begin with King and Malcolm was important because, you know, these are my heroes. These are folks, you know, being a Morehouse man, you get baptized in King. You have his statue pointing at you from King's Chapel. And in the eighth grade, I remember reciting I Have a Dream in Miss Mitchell's history class from memory. And Malcolm was the source of my first conversion experience. I read the autobiography of Malcolm X my freshman year. I'm 16 years old. And everything changes. The world makes sense now. My father's rage makes sense. My own anger makes sense. You know, my goatee, this famous little gray goatee is a testimony to that conversion experience. I'll never shave it off. And part of what I found myself as a wounded little boy reaching for was a conception of manhood that could assuage my own sense of cowardliness, the fear that was in my gut that was deposited by a father who loved me but didn't love me appropriately. My father loved me to death, the most responsible man I've ever met in my life. But he scared the living daylights out of me with a glance, with a stare. So I was afraid. I know I was afraid for most of my childhood. And I had to mask it. And when I found Malcolm, oh my God, the hyper-masculinist stance. And then I found the Black Freedom Movement, the Black Panther Party, the Nation of Islam, right? Black nationalism generally. Oh my goodness. But you know, I remember that moment, and I was reading Manning Marable's Pulitzer Prize winning biography of Malcolm with Imani Perry. And Imani said, "Why, when you read this, Malcolm is flailing and failing." And I said, "Wow, flailing and failing." And I said, oh, if we move from, I said to myself, if we move from Malcolm as shining Black Prince to Wounded Witness, then guess what? He comes closer to the ground. He becomes more of a model for me. And, you know, Cornel West used to tell me all the time, he said, Brother Eddie, we all wounded. The question you have to ask yourself is whether or not you're going to be a wounded healer or a wounded herder. I won't be a wounded witness. And so Malcolm then is not some larger than life figure to which I must supplicate. He becomes an exemplar for my own effort to speak to my own moment. So that's why I have to make my way through these folk, right? To something else, you know, so I can find my own voice.
Coming up, more with Professor Eddie S. Glaude Jr. He'll share his thoughts on Dr. Cornel West's run for president. This is Disrupted. Stay with us. Welcome back to Disrupted. I'm Kalila Brown-Dean. This hour, we're talking with Professor Eddie S. Glaude Jr. He's the James S. McDonald Distinguished University Professor of African American Studies at Princeton University. He's a frequent contributor to MSNBC and author of the new book, We Are the Leaders We Have Been Looking For. In the book and in much of his past work, Glaude talks about the life and writings of James Baldwin. This August will mark what would have been Baldwin's 100th birthday. Ask Professor Glaude how James Baldwin shapes the way that he's thinking in 2024.
Baldwin, for me, it's his insight that motivates so much of what I do. He says that the messiness of the world is actually a reflection of the messiness of our interior lives. That, you know, that wet-eyed Southern fellow who grabs his private parts, if only he would deal with what's broken inside of him, then maybe the world could be better, you know? And that's not a position, a romantic position that's naive about structural realities or power, but it's at the heart of the concern is a moral one. It's the beating heart of Baldwin's prose, the moral concern. That is, what kind of human being do you aspire to be? What kind of human being are you? And so what I learned from him and what I learned from him repeatedly, and, you know, I just came across something recently that struck me. I stopped still. It made me stand still. And the claim was, we don't return to books to reread them to find what we missed. We return to books because we've changed. And we want to see, we want to establish a new relationship to them. So here I am in this 50th decade of my life, reading Baldwin for so long. What I do know is his, it sounds cliche, but it's actually at the heart of it. We got to be better people. If we want a better world, you and I have to be better people. We can't be selfish. We can't be greedy. We can't be mean-spirited. We have to understand the significance of being loving and being decent and being caring, right? To understand that everyone, no matter their zip code, no matter their gender, no matter their color, no matter where they live, right? No matter their ability, that they should be accorded dignity and standing. And what does that look like, right? And if and that's, it's not non-ideological, it's not post-ideological, right? It's a moral claim about what kind of human being do I want to be between the short time that I breathe and the last time I take my breath, you know? And I learned that from him. And I keep going back to it. And I keep going back to it as I get older. And as I get older, I'm less reliant on ideological shortcuts that settle everything for me. You see? And I'm more interested in the hard work of living close to the ground.
That is a very different approach than the way we socialize people to think about getting older or maturing. The idea that many people have is that the older you get, the more you'll figure it all out. And in my own experience, what I'm figuring is, no, actually, the older I get, the more I interrogate everything. and move away from the idea that I'm supposed to grow into what is, and instead embrace the opportunity to challenge what
exactly.
is. So much of your work is about affirming that human capacity for change is ever evolving, that the ability to have impact is infinite. And yet, Professor, you were a guest on our very first episode of Disrupted back in 2020, right? Thank you. We were preparing for the 2020 presidential election that saw Joe Biden and Donald Trump vying to become president of the United States. And here we are back in 2024, where it looks like those will be the two candidates or major party candidates vying again. What do you make of that infinite capacity for evolution and the seeming intoxicating comfort of the status quo that many people seem willing to acquiesce to?
I mean, wow. I mean, you get to the heart of the matter. You know, we're not naive about the ways in which big money corporations have captured our politics. We're not naive about that. We're not naive about the nostalgic longing for, you know, a form of life that was disrupted by the ascendance of MAGAism and Trumpism, or however we want to describe it. You know, and I understand it for what it is. I think Americans believe that somehow this fragile experiment has been divinely sanctioned, that it can survive no matter its contradictions, that it will press on, you know, that it's always prospective, it's always future oriented, when in fact nostalgia has overrun everything in our current politics. But then, you know, as I think about that first episode, I remember returning to Baldwin's essay, his letter to Jimmy Carter, and Baldwin saying explicitly that he loathed what Carter had done, that austerity politics that had undermined policies in urban America, that Carter had in effect betrayed the Black political class that put him in office. But then he said, there's Reagan. And I know who Reagan is. I know what he does. I know what he has done. And then Baldwin dropped this line on me that I'll never forget. He said, sometimes you vote to buy yourself some time. Sometimes you vote to buy yourself some time. If Donald Trump wins this time, democracy is a wrap. I thought I had some space in 2016. There's no space in this moment. I think we have to be clear about our position vis-a-vis the Biden administration, vis-a-vis the Democratic Party as it's currently constituted. We need to get them in a position where we can then bring full critique to bear. But democracy is at stake. Democracy, the background conditions for our living are at stake. And so in this moment, I'm deeply, deeply unsatisfied with the two choices. But I also understand who one of the people actually are. That fascist, that deep, I got a piece coming out, I have a piece that just hit called The Fantasy of a Little Lily White America in Time Magazine. And the reason I wrote the piece was to remind folk what really motivates Trumpism. You know, we understand what we have. But, you know, we the leaders we've been looking for, so we have to act accordingly.
Last month, I hosted what was the late Senator Joe Lieberman's, one of his last public interviews, one of his last public conversations. And that holds all kinds of different feelings and emotions. And one of the things we talked about in that conversation was timing. And he expressed his real concerns about Trump, about fascism, about all that it represented, but the impact that it could have. And we then talked about the No Labels movement. And I asked him, is this the time to have a third party candidate, given the stakes that are there? And I so appreciated his candor and his willingness to engage that. you and I hold deep respect in many different ways for Dr. Cornel West. And people are asking the question now that he has announced that Dr. Malina Abdullah will be his running mate. And there are those who can't even think about the message, the platform, the agenda, the priorities, and most importantly, knowing Malina as I do, the people that that represents, because the immediate concern is, will this just siphon votes away? And will this deliver a victory for the person that many have concerns about? How do we meld that together? The deep love that people have for community, the stakes that are so incredibly high, as you say, and what it could mean for democracy.
Yeah, you know, it's one of the most difficult things I've had to deal with in a long time. I think I understand what motivates my good friends. He's more than my good friend. Let me be honest with you. He's the godfather of my son. I understand, and without him, I wouldn't be possible in so many ways. So I understand what motivates him in this instance. But I also think there are other things, too, that are at work. I think Doc is grieving in public in interesting sorts of ways. I understand the criticism. In fact, I made it in Democracy in Black, right? I actually put forward something similar to this. I think he's making a serious mistake in this moment. Adolph Reed has a piece in The Nation recently where he's trying to say that, you know, we have to hold off. It's a similar argument he made in his support of Clinton. And I've come around to his position. It's dangerous to allow Project 2025, Center for Renewal of America, Dominionist, Seven Mountainist, White Supremacist. It's dangerous for the people we love most to see these folk who are organized now. They didn't think he would win in 2016, so they weren't organized, but they're organized and are prepared to engage in a deliberate execution of their agenda. The danger is exponentially more than what it was in 2016. So I understand the criticism of the duopoly. I understand the criticism of the corporate takeover of the Democratic Party. I understand the criticism of the policies around immigration and the like of Biden. But the stakes, it's that other side. It's not sufficient. I know it's not going to be sufficient, especially given the backdrop of Gaza, given what's going on. They're going to have to make a much more forceful argument, but we can't let these folk get in office. We just can't let it happen. And then once the election is over, let's go at them. Tooth and nail. But we got to get them in so we can keep these folk out.
I always feel like I need much more time to talk with you and to learn with you and wrestle through these big picture things. But as our time, unfortunately, is coming to a close, I know that many of our listeners will be listening to this, and it is bleak. It is overwhelming. It is dire. But at the core of it, is that infinite possibility that you keep bringing us back to, the reminder that what Ella Baker faced seemed overwhelming, and she kept going and building and enlightening and creating something enduring. In the last part of your book, you bring us to your colleague, Imani Perry. And I say your colleague, in some ways, I feel like I should be saying comrade because of the ways that you two are building across spaces. And the last part of that book where she talks about, or you say, she's helping guide readers beyond their circumstances to what is possible. Doc, what's the future possibility that you are imagining right now?
Revolutionary possibility, yeah. You know, I think when we step into our power, when we understand our power, oh, hell is going to break loose. Change is immediate. When everyday ordinary people understand that they are the linchpin, that when we decide that we have the power to step into the breach, a new world can come into being. I end the book with this wonderful quotation from Toni Morris. And she says, of course there's cruelty. Cruelty is a mystery. But if we see the world as one long, brutal game, then we bump into another mystery. The mystery of beauty, of light, the canary that sings on the skull. Unless all ages and all races of men have been deluded, there seems to be such a thing as grace, such a thing as beauty, such a thing as harmony, all wholly free and available to us. And then the last two words of the book is to us, now fly. My abiding faith is our in the ability of everyday ordinary people to be the transforming agents that we've been looking for. So what's the possibility? Oh, us. It has always been us, and it will always be us.
Beauty, light, grace, and freedom. Thank you for reminding us to fly, Professor. Dr. Eddie S. Claude Jr. is the James S. McDonald Distinguished Professor of African American Studies at Princeton University. He's a frequent contributor to MSNBC, and his latest book is We Are the Leaders We Have Been Looking For. Thank you, Professor.
Thank you. You're so wonderful.
Disrupted is produced by Kevin Chang Barnum, Wayne Edwards, Meg Dalton, and Katie Tularski. You can listen to all the previous episodes of Disrupted by finding us wherever you get your podcast. I'm Kalila Brown-Dean. Thanks for listening.